You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, July 3rd, 2026. I'm your host, Nick Seabrook. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week, as part of our summer series, we're resharing the earliest Rabble Radio episode that still exists online. Episode 6, Out and About. Whatever happened to episodes 1 to 5, well, we're still hunting for those. But, full disclosure, after 25 years of sharing independent media, there are some things that may be just lost to time. On that note, this summer, Rabble is raising money to preserve our archives. Our work at Rabble, including on this podcast, wouldn't be possible without the support of our dedicated monthly donors. Consider becoming a donor today by visiting rabble.ca/donate. In this week's re-released episode, we speak to M. Nurbese Philip about her book, Zong. DV Diva Kathy Bond talks about what she's been watching, and we'll go on a nature walk, and more. Going back to 2005, here's the episode.
First, here's Lisa Rundell talking with writer M. Nurbese Phillips.
I'm Lisa Rundell. In this episode, I'm speaking with multiple award-winning poet, essayist, novelist, and playwright M. Nurbese Philip. I asked her about her fascinating new poetry manuscript, Zong.
I began Zong about 8 years ago, not began writing, but I first became aware of this case called the Zong case that was mentioned in a book by an English author called James Walvin. The title of the book is Black Ivory. Walvin was interested in, as he said, putting the lived experience back into that particularly horrific experience and experiment that was the transatlantic slave trade. He said that most of the books written about it tended to focus on figures and numbers and so on. In his work, Black Ivory, he mentions this particular case, the Zong case, which came about as a result of a captain who captained the slave ship that left the west coast of Africa to sail across the Atlantic with a cargo of African slaves. The name of the ship was the Zong. And I think he was inexperienced. The journey should have taken approximately 6 weeks. I think it took twice that length of time, some 3 months. And on this journey, some of the Africans became ill and died, and he, of course, had to throw them overboard. However, he conceived the idea that to save the ship owners a further loss, if he threw overboard some of the other slaves who were living, that would reduce the loss for the owners. I think he murdered some close to 200 slaves, Africans, in that way, just throwing them overboard. One record talks about slaves falling all day over the side of the ship. The case became a cause célèbre because Granville Sharp, who was one of the abolitionists, actually tried to get the captain charged with murder, which of course was unheard of in those days because the Africans were seen as property. But he wrote to the lords of various courts and so on, and that helped to galvanize the abolitionist movement. The case comes about because the insurance company refuses to pay the insurance to the owners. The owners sue the insurance company, and the matter went through the court. And I found a case which was called Gregson versus Gilbert, the names of the owners and the insurance company, respectively. And it's 2 pages long, and I kept it. And I just knew I was going to do something with it because it surprised me. Even at that time in my life where I thought I had, you know, I knew a fair bit about the slave trade. So that's how I began. And what I decided to do was I would limit myself to the words of that particular legal report. There are about 500 different words in the report. And I thought I would just fashion the poetry from those words.
Can you tell us why you decided to put yourself under that kind of constraint in the writing?
I didn't know why at the time, but as you know as a writer and others who are listening, when you're doing creative work, you often don't know why an instinct tells you, an impulse tells you to do something, but later on you understand. And the simplest answer to that question is that that's a resource that poets have always used, restraint and constraint. My definition of poetry, one of my definitions, is that it's language under pressure. And there are various ways that you put language under pressure: by restraint, there's rhyme, there is a line length. The sonnet can only be 14 lines in length. It has to have a certain kind of metrical beat, iambic pentameter. There's also other forms like the villanelle and so on, the haiku. You know, so poets have always used limitation as a way. One insight I've had since then is that, you know, in the times that we're living in now, where many of the freedoms we have taken for granted are being increasingly encroached upon, I think that limitation is something that we're all going to have to understand, and understand how we can work within and exploit limitation to actually go to another level. Song number 6. Question, therefore, the age. 18 weeks and calm. But it is said from the maps and contradicted by the evidence. Question, therefore, the age.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate talking with you today, and I know our listeners will appreciate it too. Tell us, when will Zong be coming out? When can people read it?
Zong will be out in 2006, and it's being published by Wesleyan. It's a U.S. publisher.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey there, Kathy Bond here. And over the last couple of months, Fox has been re-releasing a great spate of film noir. We all know the noir. It's a significant genre that was marked by the release of The Maltese Falcon in 1941, and critically is acknowledged as wrapping up with Orson Welles' fantastic A Touch of Evil in 1958. Critics claim that the noir was actually the darkness of the American psyche, utterly blasted by the effects of the Depression in World War II, blown up big time on the silver screen. While there are many subgenres within the noir, the two that present themselves in the new Fox re-releases are A, the gangster genre, and B, the dangers of messing with the mind, aka watch out for that cracklebat psycho shrinko. First off, Street with No Name. I thought this flick was going to be really, really, really lame. It starts off as a literal piece of propaganda sanctioned by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, acting as a cinematic treatise on the dangers of gangland America.
Victim, Helen Jennings, occupation, housewife.
Now, while that might sound kind of hokey, A Street with No Name is actually a decent nail nipper with a good script and some intriguing homoerotic undertones between the boss and members of his gang. The same is true for Samuel Fuller's House of Bamboo. While I loved watching Robert Ryan try and trap Robert Stack in his very groovy, minimalist Japanese mountain retreat, the real eye candy here is the chance to see post-war Tokyo before it was transformed into the quintessential postmodern destination. Now, what about Category B, the psychological noir? Both of these re-releases are yummy. First, out of the DVD player, Whirlpool. It's directed by Otto Preminger, ding, screenplay by Ben Hesh, ding, 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 and stars Gene Tierney and Jose Ferrer. Jose is a snake oil hypnotist come pseudo shrink who sets his sights on a wealthy kleptomaniac housewife.
There are no thoughts in your mind, no fears. Trust me, I can help you.
Does that not sound promising? But you know what's even better?
There he is, the geek. Is he man or beast? Now, folks, it's feeding time.
Lovers of vintage noir will definitely eat up Nightmare Alley. The film stars Tyrone Power as a carny mind reader with a dark past who ends up shaking hands with his id. And that, my digital vid kids, is what a good noir is all about. Come to the dark side. I'll be waiting there with an axe. For Rebel Radio, I'm Femme Fatale Bond.
It's homebrew time again here at Rebel Radio, with a story about storytelling. In community radio, the volunteer reporters usually report on situations and issues to which they are quite committed. Hence the energy to volunteer for hours and hours, week after week, trying like a lot of indie media to get out stories not available elsewhere. Frequently, we say that we're reporting in solidarity with such and such a struggle. No doubt we often are. But sometimes a sense of urgency to produce stories, or the desire to prove a point about a particular issue, overshadows the possibilities of movement building. Andrea Schmidt spent 4 months in Baghdad in the winter of 2004. Sent by the Montreal-based Iraq Solidarity Project, she went to make connections with progressive movements in Iraq. As part of this effort, she reported back regularly through the website Voices in the Wilderness and through CKUT 90.3 FM Community Radio at McGill University in Montreal. Looking back, she weighs the value of the stories she and others were producing.
People were constantly in the mainstream media and in the independent media, were going around asking people, well, you know, the sort of like Iraqi on the street interview, you know, which was always, what was worse, Saddam or the Americans, right? And there's always a sense that you'd hope that they would say, well, the Americans are so much worse, so that you could say, see, the occupation is bad. But of course, that's a fascist question in some sense, because it doesn't allow people to frame their own question about what sort of society would you want to live in. It determines a choice between two completely untenable options.
I'm in a cab with Haider and Saif. So where are we?
We are now in Sadr city. This is area.
It would have been closer to the goals, I think, of autonomous media had we not been asking that sort of question, not been focused solely on proving that the U.S. occupation was bad in the most simplistic sense possible. It would have been much more useful, I think, to be there and to be slowly trying to learn from Iraqis what sort of questions they wanted to ask about what was possible in their country. How would they have framed questions, and then how would they have answered them, and how would we have amplified those voices and those stories that came out of that process?
They have. Why some people has freedom, some people not? That's crazy.
I'm not really sure that I could have done that in that context, because A, I don't speak Arabic, B, it was sort of, you know, the very difficult context. And I'm not sure that that sort of exchange, which would be the most useful form and the most, I think, genuinely autonomous and autonomy-building form of media production, I'm not sure that that's actually possible in a place where there isn't already a movement that has identified itself publicly as a progressive movement that wants to call in international solidarity and is capable and strong enough of telling that international solidarity movement how it wants to work with it, how they want to use the resources that they can offer, what sort of exchanges are possible, and which ones just simply aren't. Which doesn't mean I don't think that there's no role for independent reporting, because I think that when those movements don't exist, or when we haven't been able to see them yet because of our own blinders, perhaps, or because of other political circumstances, I do think that there is utility in reporting, perhaps not even so much on what's going on in Iraq for Iraqis, but trying to do the sort of investigative journalism that really tries to expose the role of our government, the United States government, the Canadian government, in creating the context which make it impossible for those sorts of progressive movements to flourish.
Andrea's independent reporting work has currently taken her to Haiti to investigate Canada's role in the recent destabilization and overthrow of democratically elected President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Her dispatches are available at www.nologo.org. Her essay, Independent Reporting, A Tool for International Solidarity Building, is part of the collection Autonomous Media, edited by Andrea Langlois and Frédéric Dubois, and published by Cumulus Press in 2005. For Rebel Radio, I'm Jen Moore.
Hello, this is Charlotte Scott. It's a beautiful day in mid-October, and I'm in Toronto's High Park, located in the city's West End. I'm here today with Zoe and Marnie, two interpreters at the High Park Nature Centre, and about 30 young naturalists from the Parkdale Montessori School. We're getting ready to go on a nature hike, a scavenger hunt, and then we're going to plant some flowers for monarch butterflies, who are on their way south for the winter and like to rest their wings in High Park's oak savanna.
My name is Zoe. I work at the High Park Nature Centre as an interpreter, and I'm standing right now on the Black Oak Savanna. So I see a lot of oaks in front of me and a lot of tall grasses and some goldenrod and some fall blooming flowers. It's quite lovely.
Excellent. That's really good. So we're going to go on a nature walk with a whole bunch of people. Can anyone think of any good things to remember if you're on a nature walk with lots of people? What are some good rules to remember? What do you think?
The Nature Center was started in 1999, and we were doing programs in the summer then for a few years. And then last year, 2004, was the first year that we started doing programs all year round, so they hired two full-time staff members. And yeah, we just do different themed programs of the seasons, but basically the overall goal of them is just to help kids develop a sense of stewardship for the park and an understanding of the restoration that goes on here, and just kind of knowing how important the park is and that it's like this huge piece of nature in the middle of the city, and sort of get people to care for it and to realize that it's really special for that reason.
If you're walking outside and you're using a really loud voice because you're really excited to be on a nature walk, do you think you're going to see a lot of animals?
No.
No, because how will the animals feel?
In the summertime, we get mostly daycare groups. And then in the fall and winter, it's mostly school programs. So a class will book a visit, and we try to make the programs connect with the curriculum. So every grade, in grade four, they study habitats, and so we'll focus on habitats in High Park. So it links up with the curriculum a little bit.
If I'm walking along and I see a beautiful flower, do you think I should pick it and take it home for my mom?
No.
What do you think? How come it's not a good idea?
I love doing bug programs just because every kid has some sort of relationship with bugs, so you either love them and you want to catch them, or you think they're disgusting and gross, but even that you can channel into some sort of interest, but no one ever thinks it's boring. And you can see the same things every day, but it's still exciting to find a grasshopper. So I love that, and I also really love the planting program.
And as soon as we're ready, then we can go.
My name is Marnie, right now we're hiking with about 500 kids through High Park, and we are observing the natural world, going for scavenger hunts and finding things like pine cones and fluffy seeds, and looking for how we can find wind in a place and monarch butterflies and migratory patterns.
So have you guys seen any animals yet?
Yeah. We
saw squirrels. And we saw dogs.
Whoa. I saw two.
I saw two.
I saw three.
All right, chickadee-dee-dee. Who here is tired after that long walk? Put up your hand if you're a little tired. Put up your hand if you're not tired at all. Some of us are kind of tough. So this area here, this kind of a habitat is called the savanna. Could everyone say savanna? And in the savanna, there's some very special trees called black oak trees. Some of them are very old. They're 150 years old, and this is what their leaves look like. There's also a lot of grasses and flowers in the savanna. What kind of animals do you think would like trees and grass and flowers? What kind of animals do you think would live here?
Chipmunks.
Squirrels. What else do you think? Birds would eat the seeds that the flowers make. What else?
Butterflies.
What other animals?
Bumblebees.
And wasps.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be planting plants today. Probably not giraffes, but by planting plants, we're going to be helping all those animals, and we'll be helping mice and squirrels. The kids right now are working on planting some plants. We're doing a big restoration of the savanna, and so part of that restoration is planting native plants in different areas, and so that's what they're working on right now. We are planting some black-eyed Susans, as well as a couple of different kinds of asters, and a prairie grass called Little Blue Stem.
I need water.
Some water? Sure.
Me too.
So what is the value of teaching little kids to plant in High Park?
I would say, like, because they're children, and just instilling in them a sense of a connection with the environment, and understanding is, like, the first part, and hopefully, like, they'll go away, and when they're looking around the world in any sense, like, that they'll understand a bit more of the cycle of things, and where things come from, and feel a little more connected and secure in the universe.
To find out more about High Park, the Oak Savannah, and the Nature Center, go to hpcharity.org or check out Rebel's show notes for a complete set of links and contacts. Thank you so much to all the volunteers, interpreters, parents, and especially the great kids who made this such a fun sound tour. This is Charlotte Scott for Rebel Radio.
That was a clip from the earliest episode of Rabble Radio we've still got. To listen to the full original program, visit the link in the show notes of this episode. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. This week's In Case You Missed It is being read by Rabble's Hannah Bolwell. Take it away, Hannah.
Starting this week in national politics, July 1st was the deadline to begin renegotiations for the Canada-United States-Mexico Agreement, which is also known as CUSMA. While Canada and Mexico are both keen on renewing the free trade agreement, the United States has given notice of their intention to withdraw from the agreement, despite the deal being initially created by U.S. President Donald Trump. This means that the parties have 6 months to renegotiate CUSMA. If it's not renegotiated, the U.S. could completely withdraw from the agreement in 10 years. Some longtime observers of North American trade believe this is President Trump's attempt to gain leverage over Prime Minister Mark Carney and Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum Pardo. Others, like fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Diego Marquin Bitar, view this as an attempt to draw out the negotiation period. Prior to this renegotiation period, transnational fair trade activists have been protesting against the terms of CUSMA's review under the banner Days of Solidarity. the coalition of civil society groups drafted a trilateral statement to send to each country's trade representative that calls for, quote, strengthening rural communities, improving conditions for workers, taking environmental crises, Afro-descendant and indigenous rights seriously, removing giveaways to big tech, and tackling gun violence, end quote. This statement comes after progressive groups accused CUSMA of continuously eroding workers' rights and wages, contributing to accelerated environmental destruction, ignoring indigenous rights, and even shortening our overall lifespans. Progressives also argue that CUSMA is prioritizing the interests of corporations rather than the well-being of citizens and communities. While none of the letters from Days of Solidarity have received a response, there is still hope that delaying negotiations could lead to a favorable outcome for fair trade activists. In labor news, the Canada Industrial Relations Board, also known as CIRB, made a precedent-setting ruling in a case against the alleged use of replacement workers, or scabs, by Canadian Pacific Kansas City, or CPKC, during illegal employee strike. The International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, also known as IBEW, System Council 11, representing the rail workers of CPKC, have been on strike since May 31st. Spending more than a month on the picket line without earning any income. During that time, CPKC had been using the contractor PNR, Railworks Inc., to perform duties outside the scope of their contracts, and that would fall under the responsibilities of the striking workers. However, this is not an isolated scab labor incident. In a similar labor dispute between United Steelworkers and Rogers, the employer brought in outside managers to perform unionized work. On June 8th, NDP MP Don Davies tabled a bill that would close this loophole. Alexander Young, president of IBEW Local 2008, is optimistic that the CIRB ruling could set a precedent that discourages the use of scab workers and that the proposed bill could provide workers with, quote, the upper hand, end quote. And finally, in environmental news, David Suzuki writes about what fungi can teach us about the importance of interconnectivity in a time where greed and ignorance reign supreme. The symbiotic relationship between fungi and plants is an essential life-supporting network that human activity keeps interrupting. From fertilizer, fungicide, and tilling, to single-species plantation after logging, we are only causing a detrimental effect to nature in the long run. Suzuki connects the interconnectedness of fungal networks to indigenous knowledge, where everything, past, present, and future, is considered before interacting with the land. This way of thinking is essential for us to adopt in order to prevent the ruin of our health and our planet. As always, you can read the full versions of all of these stories talked about today on rabble.ca.
And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks so much for listening. To help support our show further, consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. You can also choose to subscribe to us over on Patreon for special bonus content of Rabble Radio. If you're already subscribed, consider making a donation to rabble.ca at rabble.ca/donate. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. And thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music to this episode. I'm Nick Seabrook, and we'll talk to you next time.